I know it's weekend, but actually, since I'm giving like Vajrayana and Tantric teachings, it's even more important than like Monday night or Sunday to have a sense of decorum, you know, like that. Otherwise, I can't give the teachings if there's too much informality, you know. So I know it's weekend. So just FYI, you know, so the same, you know, we're going to do prayers and vows and create a sacred environment, or otherwise, you know, the Buddha can't teach. You know, it all depends upon creating a certain kind of environment so people are receptive and can listen. You know, so you know, we're calling a meditation workshop, but actually quite sacred space. And even though beginners are coming, I'm hoping that enough tantrikas are here so we create that kind of vibration or energy that contains the truth like that. So it's my responsibility too as the abbot, spiritual director, to create that sacred space and to inspire that in others so that they can hear Dharma, you know, so it's not totally like one way, you know. I have to also create enough dignity, enough wisdom, enough energy so that people don't listen with their ordinary minds. They're not just chattering away with their ordinary thoughts, but you're practicing like you're sitting on the edge of a cliff. That is the proper way to do a retreat. So there was a time, and maybe we can do it in the future, where I've done some retreats at Marin Headlands in Golden Gate Recreational Area, is that what it's called. And you can literally sit on an edge of a cliff there. My teacher said at the time, well, the only thing better than sitting on the edge of a cliff is having someone hold a knife at your throat while you're meditating. you know, it's interesting. That's Vajrayana style, as we compare, we hold together the urgency and the heightened energy of sitting on the edge of a cliff with a complete sense of rest and relaxation of being, you know, totally in your ancestral home. We combine the aspect of complete stillness or shine, calm abiding, with the highly energized and awake state of Tantra. It's an interesting path, right? Because usually people are one or other. They're usually, you know, freaks, kind of adrenaline freaks, you know, that like going after high energy things, or they totally just want to, you know, kind of sleep their life away. So today we're going to do prayers just like regular, but the theme for the retreat is I'd like to give some teachings on Milam on Dream Yoga today. So these are actually some advanced teachings, but like many of the advanced teachings, if you're not ready, you won't hear it anyway, so they are self-secret. But the danger with Vajrayana teachings is not that people will gain realizations, because that's what we want. The danger is that people will mistake the teachings and harm themselves. This is actually, I've been around long enough at this point that I have encountered that quite a bit, where people become either overly discouraged, I can't do this, it's too hard, or you know, completely arrogant and grandiose. You know, actually, I had one person I had to visit at Sac Main Hospital a number of years ago who decided they were Maitreya Buddha because they were doing some loving kindness practice. We are essentially inside loving Buddha, but you can't work in a law firm that way. And go to court and say, well, I'm Maitreya, so judge, you should do this. So unfortunately, he lost his law job, right? So we don't want to do that, you know. So we can be conventional on the outside and unconventional on the inside. Isn't that nice? So perfect. Okay, so we're going to do prayers to get started, and we'll go from there. But today we're going to talk about dream yoga. Thank you. So even though, we call this workshop, I didn't want to call it retreat because retreat always for me means kind of like overnight, you know. But Ellen very graciously has invited me to give a retreat at Lotus View, which means we will have a couple of overnights. So the retreat will be primarily on, Mahamudra. But it's restricted to, people that have taken refuge. And it's further restricted. I mean, you have to get permission first. When I told James this, he says, "Wow, you're really ratcheting down." But when you go on retreat, particularly overnights, you really want to be with people you trust and also people that can do the practice, right? Of course, have good habits and social skills, but also can really benefit from it. So I think we'll be sending out that announcement soon, right? Finalized details. Yeah, so May 5th to the 7th. Like that. And and it's really great to do retreat in the outside where the elements are very supportive and also somewhat unpredictable, I'm assuming, still. We never know now. Maybe it'll still rain. Who knows, right? Maybe it'll snow in May. Who knows? So that's an important retreat. Now that many people in the Sangha have attained enough maturity that they can see the nature of mind, then we can benefit. So, very good. So in dream yoga, it's very easy because we all dream. So that's why when people do darshan with me, I like asking about your dreams. Just overview real quick, because dream yoga is approached, sometimes different ways. It's part of the six dharmas of Naropa. It's also, part of, training in bardo states, the in-between states after death. And it's also something that we recite every time we come here, right? Somewhat things are like a dream. And it's what we learned as children if we were singing rounds like "Row, row, row your boat." Definitely Dharma song, right? I don't know. My teacher would get us to sing, so to be warned, might have to sing "Row, row, row your boat." So, the last time I started talking about the different styles of practice is healing and pacifying practice. When people start, they're really usually somewhat in crisis and needs to be healed, and then they need to calm down, and it's only later they can develop some emotional receptivity and attachment and devotion, and then at that point they're ready to get energized. So we'll do some energy practices again, some salung. Sa means channels and lung means wind. Salung, channel wind practice. And then after we're energized, we do action practice. So action practice is, straightening the cushions or just doing something active. And then this insight and then the study practice too, of course, study and insight, and finally wisdom practice. So those or actually that's kind of my formulation of the Eightfold Path, right? Many times when people hear Eightfold Path, like, you know, right view, right, you know, intention, right speech, right action, they've heard it so many times that it's good to hear it in a little different way from a very practice orientation, you know. Particularly when we put right in front of it, it always sounds a little churchy to me. Doesn't it? You know, like, okay. Right is the translation of the Sanskrit samyak. Maybe right's, you know, like, right on, or correct, or complete. So these are different words, but I'm trying to give it really a practice orientation. So how do we really start? We start with healing, you know. So we don't actually start sometimes with right view, do we? We start with healing, then we have to settle down, then we have to reconnect, then we have to get energized, then we have to do something with that energy, then we study, and then we gain insight, and then we gain wisdom. So so where does dream yoga fit into Eightfold Path? It's actually very much an insight and wisdom practice, because the understanding is that we'll be able to recognize when we're dreaming, and in the middle of the dream, recognize the, you know, clear light mind. In Western psychology, and recently we've heard the term a lot, lucid dreaming. Anybody hear that term? Yeah. The Western psychology style is going to be a little bit different, because primarily in lucid dreaming, we're interested in you know, transforming the dream. So, you know, going, being in the dream and going, hey, instead of falling down and dying in this dream, I'm going to fly. Okay. And that's part of traditional dream yoga too. But in Western dreaming, usually it's about having a positive, well-adjusted dream or something like that. And it's not particularly going after the nature of self. Whereas in the dream yogas in Vajrayana, of course, we want to go after the you know, the root causes of samsara and the root reality. We want to see nature of mind, nature of phenomena, nature of self. So it's sophisticated practice, but at the same time, because dreams are so interesting, it's easy practice to start with. So we have some time today, and we start early today, so it's actually possible to be a little dreamy. So we're going to sit a little bit, and usually, of course, in mindfulness meditation, particularly the way it's presented in the West, you know, you want to be wide awake mindful, right? But actually, here we want to be a little drifty, dreamy, mindful. I had the opportunity to, take teachings very briefly from His Holiness Dujin Rinpoche, and then extensively from one of his students. And I always like to know kind of what, like to talk about just how lamas are in daily life. And so I asked Choji Rinpoche, I said, what was Rinpoche like? You know, we talked, and he said, well, Rinpoche was always like forgetting things. And, you know, I was like, what was your name? And and kind of busting, you know, Rinpoche's idea that, you know, enlightenment meant you're some kind of mindfulness, you know, on the spot, super memory, super perfect, always get it right, always be in the present kind of person, you know, like that. Because then you can get this kind of weird perfectionist, mindfulness, Dharma stuff going on. Anybody can relate with that? In Vajrayana, when we're talking about mindfulness, we are talking about, you know, not knocking over the teacup on one level, but we're being mindful of clear light mind. You know, that's the real mindfulness. And we're being mindful of, you know, the nature of phenomena, which are dreamlike. And we're being mindful of the nature of self, which can't be found. So, although today, if I'm not very mindful, I'm not going to claim I'm being mindful of the clear light. I'm just overcoming pain medication, so... So, you know, the ongoing debate when I study with Trungpa Rinpoche is Rinpoche in clear light mind, or has he had too much to drink? You know, it's like one of those problems. Is it possible for us to do like a sitting before a break where we can try to be dreamy and maybe even a little bit capture the nighttime dream you picked up? Is that possible? So the style meditation practice, probably eyes closed is best, right? Unless you recognize that all phenomena are dreamlike, I would close your eyes and allow yourself to drift back into dreamland for a few moments. And if we hear a few people snoring, it's okay, right? So we just, you know, we have just 15, 20 minutes. That's all we need. Is it hard dreaming, sitting up? No. Well, you know, actually one's, you know, sleep postures, also affect the, you know, winds and the channels. You know, in some dream yoga's teachings, you're, you know, sleeping on your right side, actually, in what's called lion's pose, you know, like this, right? So people sometimes have seen statues, which are mostly from Southeast Asia, interestingly, you know, Buddha reclining like that. That's how he died. That's not sleeping, actually. But because he died that way, also some sleep yogas are that way too. And, you know, some of it is like you're pressing against this nerve here, right? So, actually I usually sleep that way, but because of the hernia, I've had to sleep on my back. And I've had different dreams. It's a little hard. If you're not a back sleeper, you know, it's different. But it's kind of like, you know, it's corpse pose, so you're just kind of there. So it's in some ways, you know, different, more lucid for me. So that's interesting. And then, so different sides mean different things. And also in some traditions, Vajrayana traditions, like in Kargyu three-year retreat, they actually put you in like a meditation box. So, of course, you get out for ceremonies and to do your business and food and everything, but you actually sleep in your box. You're supposed to sleep sitting up. It never really works that way because people end up just kind of like slumping down, you know. I don't know. And none of the Westerners I've talked to is like, you know, said, oh yeah, I'm just sleeping like this. You know, you just end up kind of, you know, pretzel, like you're sleeping in your car. Remember those days? You know, or something. Also, it's sometimes easier to do dream yoga, honestly, when you're a little bit tired, you know? Maybe naturally. So in Vajrayana practice, we want people to have a lot of energy and, you know, aspiration, devotion, all that. But two times when it's really beneficial to practice, when times are multiplied, so to speak, is when you're tired and when you're sick. When you're tired, your duality, your mistaken self is tired too, right? Makes sense. So many times on retreats, you know, people, you're meant to get kind of tired out, right? In many, not just Buddhist retreats, but, you know, different things where you just get really tired, you know, as sometimes they call it sleep deprivation. But the idea is because we're tired in a way, you know, our misperceived self, our ego is tired too. Then also sick. So I don't like getting sick. I don't like being sick now. But actually, when we're sick physically, and mentally too, the skandhas are constituents of who we actually are, you know, form and feeling, sensation, perception, consciousness, and emotions, you know, those are looser too, you know. So when you're sick, you don't feel as solid, do you? I don't, you know. When we're feeling good, we feel like, I'm me, and I can do anything, and nothing can harm me. It feels really like 17 years old again. But when we're ill, you know, just, oh God, I feel like dying, and, you know, it's falling apart. And so that's ideal opportunity to look into the nature of things at that point, because you feel like shit. So to look at that, you know, and go, okay, I don't feel as solid. I don't feel... this eye can be examined very more closely sometimes at that point. The thing is to examine ourselves, to wake up when we're feeling sick or sleepy, we actually do have to have a lot of aspiration. So we have that momentum, right? Like I grew up skating on, learning to ice skate in New York on ponds, you know. So I was taught and I found out that actually if you have enough momentum, you can kind of skate over thin ice. Is that true? Any other skaters here? Yeah. So the momentum of our bodhicitta, of our aspiration to benefit others, wake up, so forth, if that's strong, then when we're, you know, sick, dying even, of course, when we're tired, then the momentum carries you forward as the rest of you is falling apart. And dream time and dreams, it may feel very solid, but generally in regular dreams, things are not as solid. They're somewhat more chaotic, somewhat weird. People are doing many times things differently than we expect. So it's a lot like real life, isn't it? It's like people are not behaving, things are changing rapidly, it doesn't make sense, it's chaotic. Or today we'll examine some of the capacities of dreams and notice how that's actually just like daily life. Also, in dreams, it feels real, usually, unless we're doing dream yoga or lucid dreaming, the dream feels real, right? Like it's really happening. Well, isn't that a lot like daily life? It feels like it's really happening, right? Okay. So there's an analytical side to dream yoga too, where, we compare things just rationally, analytically, how do we really, really differentiate between, dreaming and what we call awake consciousness? It's a little tougher than you think, We feel we're having real experience in dreams. We feel we're having pain. We feel we're being chased. We feel we're having blissful experiences. We feel we're getting mad at people. They're getting mad at us. All these different things are happening. I do want to do some walking meditation in a moment, but maybe we have time for some people have some questions like, where is this workshop going? Or or just about dreams. Hi, Dana. Yeah.
I'm wondering how your
That's a good question. I generally like people to try to remember and write down their dreams if they can. And I notice that most people kind of skip what they think of as like ordinary dreams. Huge mistake. People are waiting for some kind of dragon and unicorn dreams usually. Ordinary dreams are extremely important because life is ordinary. So if we can find the sacred in the ordinary, then you're very close to awakening, aren't you? If we skip over some experiences and say these are important, these are unimportant, isn't that why we're trapped? So in Tantra Idea, we're having realization experiences all the time, seeing nature, clear light mind, seeing who we are, but we just skip over it. We go, well, that's not important. So we should write down our dreams. And most of the time, they're dream shards, I call them, right? So we need to be dream archaeologists. We discover, just an image or something incomplete. But if there's one piece of pottery, one piece of dream around, there's probably another piece of dream somewhere else, maybe next night or next week or something, or even from way in the past. Also, with just a little piece of dream, it's hard to demonstrate. Here's my envelope. So, and there's a phrase in Tibetan and in Dzogchen, Mahamudra, where you say, if you grab the corner, the whole piece comes along. If you grab a piece of the cloth, the whole piece comes. This is a very profound teaching. So of course we get the cloth metaphor, but I doubt if people really get what that means for the nature mind. If you just grab you have good little pincers here, you just grab just the corner. That's all you need. That's why one of my old teachers just said, you just need 5%. Capiche? You just need 5%. Whereas most of us, 110% are types. you know, to move the rug in the center there, we just need to grab the corner, right? Everyone knows this, or at least grab the edge. We wouldn't try to go to the center and then pick up the rug from the center, would you? You wouldn't be able to do it. So that's why, like, I read the poem from Michael Wigner from Zen Center last time, like, we need more Zen corners, not Zen centers. The center is everywhere, but you need to grab things by the corners. We all have a lot of corners, don't we? Little sharp points, don't we? Even ordinary dreams are important. Repetitive dreams are always really interesting. I keep having the same dream over and over. I wish it would go away. I found in my office at Middleway Health that if I don't answer the doorbell, people generally keep knocking and ringing. So just get out. I'll just get up and answer it. You know, that goes against psychoanalytic technique. You know, you're not supposed to interrupt the psychoanalytic container. But you know, if you don't answer the door, actually, and most times people don't go away. Like the FedEx driver will not go away. You know, because they get paid. They got to deliver their package, and they will. So just get the door. Thanks a lot. So many times with repetitive dreams and nightmares also, it started out as gentle knocking. But we don't answer it. We go, that's nothing. You know, knocking louder, you know. So many times nightmares, we can go into this later, but nightmares are, you know, the FedEx driver really trying to get in. Somebody's got to tell us something. You know, the water's rising, you know, like time to leave. So we'll deal with some of these dreams, like when I talk about Lotus Sutra on Monday nights. The parable of the burning house, right? The Buddha starts knocking. It's smoking in there. And I smell fire. You know, kids don't get out, so has to come up with another way to get the kids out of the house. So it's very important to answer the dreams. One more question. Generally, you know, this posture, like on, you know, you're lying on your right side, they say, you know, but you know, lots of times for the smoothest flow of our winds and channels, of course, we're taking, you know, a sitting posture, like a Padmasana posture, so like that. That's why, you know, if you can, you know, sleep sitting up. Actually, you can do it. We know we can because we went to school, right? So we go to meetings, you know? Right. So just a little story. So maybe next year, not this year, you know, Geshe Damchala will go back to do some more Tantra training, because after the university, Sarojay University Monastery training, then you might take a little time off, but then you go on for further training at Tantra Monastery, learn all the rituals and tantras and stuff. Some of the ceremonies are like 4 or 5 hours long. and you haven't gotten a lot of sleep. So some of the way to kind of like you kind of do this, and then you kind of, you know, you brace it like this so your arm doesn't go down. And you know, they don't allow you to do, sometimes it's really cold, you know, and you're on retreat, you're doing like this, but Himalaya, you wouldn't make it in the monastery because they don't allow you to kind of hide out there because they know what you're doing. So, but you can kind of like, you can kind of, you know, it looks a little bit like, they'll catch you, you know, a little bit like that, you know. Do they? They can. They actually can. They actually do have a stick sometimes, but they usually don't. You know, this is kind of sidelight, but in the monastery, you know, it's very strong social cohesion. So if you're a slacker, people will kid you about it. You know, that in that, or, you know, if you're really a serious kind of slacker, you know, you'll just get kind of ostracized. That's much more powerful than being hit, you know, honestly. I mean, everyone can take a little bonk, wake up, you know, but, you know, you don't want really your fellows to see you as like, you know, slacker. So, but still, you know, you're kind of, so we'll do some long retreats at some point where people are kind of like that, right? That style where you start falling asleep and then, like, one last question. Come along, yeah, question. Yeah. Why do you have to wake up? Okay. Yeah. Not the big wake up, just normal wake up. Yeah. You know, so just appreciate those different states for now. Most people, you know, get up too fast. I don't know why, you know, like, there's so many people that just, you got to be at work at 8. So you just, like, you wake up at the very last minute, particularly after punching the snooze button for a while. I don't, you know, why do that? You know, so you want to start, you want to transition very slowly from deep sleep to, you know, getting out of bed. That's an important practice. You really don't want to have the alarm going off and freaking you out from a deep sleep. you want to train yourself to ideally kind of, you know, really slowly wake up so you can go through these different stages of consciousness. That's a good question. You know, like that. At least have a little kind of Zen clock that maybe goes ding, you know. Do you want to start off the day in trauma? You know, no. But you want to wake up before the kids, right? Got it. See, I can't remember your name. You had a question. Daniel. Okay, yeah. Well, a very common obstacle is like an incredibly loud alarm that freaks you out. That will generally banish. Mm-hmm. Then a cat that jumps on your head in the morning. No, that's, you know, it's possible. So the biggest obstacle is people generally in this culture are conditioned to start thinking immediately about what they have to do. Because once you go into, to do a task consciousness, I have to feed the cat, I have to make the coffee, I have, you know, generally the subtle nature consciousness is out the door. That's why you want to wake up slowly, because if you think, well, I'm sleep deprived, so I got to sleep until the very last second, and then, you know, somebody's shaking us or throwing water in our face, then the dream's going to leave, because it's shocking. No wonder that so many people are traumatized, you know, like that. So you want to train yourself to actually not have to jump out of bed right away. Is that possible? Can you do that? Yeah, you know. So it means actually training yourself to wake up or start the waking up process, you know, a little earlier. Half an hour. Does everyone have an extra half hour, right? Yeah. Actually, you'll find out you sleep better. And of course, going to sleep, we'll talk about that after the break. It's just basic things, but that's a good question, yeah. you don't want to try to wake up too fast. And you don't want to try to, just one last thing is, actually, you don't want to move because movement's going to, you know, jolt us a little bit more into, task consciousness, regular, ordinary consciousness. That's why, when we're really doing the deep yogas, people really settle into not moving in their meditation. You know, that almost look like rocks sitting there. Because if you wake up and you're after the dream and then you start doing that, it'll generally leave. Isn't that people's experience? You know? Yeah, so you have to kind of just be a little bit still like that. There are other techniques like generally the 2 hours before you get up are going to be the best dream time. So consciousness for most people is very subtle between like 3 and 5 or 3 and 6, something like that, or on the weekends, you know, it's like that time, that whatever the 2 hour time is before you wake up. So in some techniques, you actually program yourself to wake up briefly for a few minutes and actually tell yourself, I want to remember my dream, and then go back to sleep. And sometimes you need a dream journal right by the bed. And you don't turn on a light, you just kind of scribble it in with a pencil or something, or, you know. And then you can write it down more. You don't want to turn on a light, and then that's not a good idea. So when we do walking meditation, that's the time we also break, and people use restroom, but we walk around in a circle. Do we have some walking meditators here right now? Need to stretch? So I usually walk right out here and then just start walking around. So we have about 10 minutes for that. Okay. Some people don't like walking meditation. I had one student, I would never walk. I just go, can I have permission to keep sitting? No. But maybe now that this person's older, maybe they're walking. in Vajrayana Tantra, particularly maybe in Tibet, you know, people have different styles of practice. Probably the strongest style, you know, was the dreamers, which are the yogis, and then the artists and the lovers, right? Dreamers, artists, and lovers. It's wonderful, right? You know, really emphasis on that sensuality of Tantra and the expressiveness and art and the spaciousness and delight and yoga. But they weren't as strong, and maybe it's Dharma's fault, I don't know, but not so strong on business and government and, you know, warriorship, right? You know, those are also practice archetypes. And so Shakyamuni was of the Kshatriya class, warrior class, and, you know, really was good at it administrating too, right? You know, so, you know, really organize the Sangha and the rules. You need that, you know. That's why we're here today. It's not because, actually, because of the yogis, the artists, the lovers, because of his organizational ability, so the Sangha kept together. You know, people say they don't like disorganized organized religion. So the Dalai Lama said, yeah, Dharma, Buddha's largest disorganized religion. But you need some, you know, you can't keep it going. And then as warrior, also, he trained in martial arts and archery and wrestling and stuff like that. So there's strong energy. This warrior spirit at Sarajay, you know, most of the time we think of monks as kind of, and nuns too, as kind of being very meek, self-effacing, maybe a little skinny or something. But actually, there's kind of this, you know, there's a little bit hefty monastic experience. But overall in Tibet, they're towards yogi and lover and artist. So here in America, we have to have the balance, you know, so we need warriors, warrior spirit, you know. So some people might ask Dane about Veterans Path, you know. We need warrior spirit. We need leadership experience. We need strong administrators. And, you know, we also need strong business people. So Ellen's done like a couple of Right Livelihood trainings, right? So so business and leadership and warrior spirit are also essential to Dharma practice. We need that. We need that balance. But in Tibet, they put so much emphasis on sitting and study and art and, you know, Tantra that, you know, the Tibetan army wasn't very big in 1950. I mean, I get it. I think the band was maybe bigger, the Tibetan band. So. But we wouldn't be here, you know, really, if not for the dreamers. So I want to point out an important thing that's overlooked sometimes. Of course, the central piece in Buddha's life is, you know, his deep realization experience under the Bodhi tree. But he wouldn't have had that if it weren't for an early experience as a 10 or 11-year-old, you know, pre-adolescent, where one day he was being a kid and wasn't participating in the fertility rites or the spring rites that his father and the rest of the tribe was engaging in. And he described how he was resting under a tree watching his father do some plowing. Now, as the king, you normally wouldn't do plowing, but it was ceremonial, right, you know, to do that. I was sitting under this wonderful kind of apple tree or something, and a profound sense of inner peace and delight came over him. you know, 11, 10, 11-year-old, 12 maybe. So Of course, you know, that faded at some point. They said, "Where's Siddhartha?" You know, and somebody probably got him from the tree. But later, you know, I'm sure he forgot about it on some level, but later when he was undergoing austerities, or we should say self-punishing behavior, not really getting anywhere, he remembered that kind of dreamy place. It was warm springtime, you know, there were probably around this time, you know, April, May kind of area, probably full moon time. So he remembered, like, wow, you know, that place, that experience, that there's something there that I want to remember and recapture. There's that's the gateway to, you know, realization or the middle way. I wasn't pushing and I wasn't pulling. I wasn't, you know, in a struggle, but I was, you know, I was just kind of restfully present. So that experience became really important to remember. And that was kind of a dreamy experience. It was awake, but very not, you know, he didn't sit under the tree going, "Now I'm going to meditate," and you know, just kind of looking, you know, at ceremonies, his dad kind of plowing, right? There's a point to this discussion. So not only was he kind of in a dreamy place, but he was in this kind of gazing at an image. So it wasn't that his eyes were closed and he was kind of going, "Oh, I'm really tired. I hate these long ceremonies. I just want to, you know, go out and play." You know, he was looking at something. So he was gazing actually at an image that was very both interesting and rhythmic and soothing. It was dreamy. He didn't have to do anything with it, right? You know, as a kid, he's watching a ceremony. He didn't have to, like, do anything. Just kind of, you know, present to it. Not really watching either, just kind of leaning back. So in doing meditation, particularly doing dream work, we want to connect with that kind of experience where we're present to the image, you know, where there's not a need for a discursive explanation, right? Because that's one thing that's kind of characteristic about dreams, nighttime dreams, is usually the images and the experiences are kind of just happening without a lot of discursive explanation. You can have very cognitive dreams, but overall compared to normal waking ego life, there's a lot less cognitive chatter going on. They're just, the images are just presenting themselves. So in dream work and of course nighttime dreams, we're kind of absorbed in the image in an interactional way. We're not totally quite becoming the image. It's not quite becoming us. We're kind of present with it as a dance partner. So that's why art and expressive things are so important in Vajrayana, because we're having that relationship between image and you know, presence. So the meditation I'd like to suggest to people is, you know, now that you've been a little dreamy, hopefully, is going back into that dream state and finding a soothing image, hopefully, or something could be classical image, but an image that we that will allow us to be, you know, captured a little bit, or that we want to relate to, where we have a little bit of sense of, like, oh, you know, not it doesn't have to be super awe-like, but just that. What you would imagine it'd be like to just relax and just gently watch, gently be present. So, you know, just about my own experience, since I'm a shallow person, I have that restful state sitting in the mall and just watching. So it's very like our airport, you know, it's just kind of done my shopping and I'm sitting there with my little Nordstrom bag and people are, they're just walking by, you know. It's dreamy and the images are coming and they're going. It's just this kind of flowing and like that, you know. So I'm just sitting there, you know. So that's my big one. But, you know, I want each person to find, like, what's that flowing sense of imagery where the images are kind of approaching you. So a famous Zen poem by the Zen master Dogen said, when we chase the images, that's delusion. When we allow the images, the phenomena to come to us, that's realization. So there's a sense of that image and the experience is kind of flowing towards you this way a little bit. So it's not the linear watching experience, like, you know, it's going from here to here, like when we're reading. So we're not doing watching meditation. We're, it's like a ceremony, or it's coming a little bit closer, like that. So that's why in the formal meditations, we visualize, you know, like the Buddhas and the Devas emerging from lotuses or emerging from clouds, because there's a sense of approach, right? We're not chasing after them like we're chasing normally after our thoughts. We're kind of like under our tree, or I'm sitting on my bench at the Galleria, and they're approaching like that. Isn't that nice? You know, so you want to find an image that a little bit grabby, but really approaching, right? Yes. Yeah, sound. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No. There's, the goddesses always come with bells, you know. So of course the integration of all our sensory experience, which includes awareness, of course, is realization. I mean, that's it. So, but you know, when you say image, yeah, that's a good point. The image isn't like flat, just one. It's not just a visual. There's, you know, so there's, you know, there could be smell too, right? You know, so sitting under a nice tree, or someone with powerful perfume arrives, you know, and you know, it all comes together, yeah, like that. So that, thank you for clarifying. When we say image, we mean that the whole sensual gestalt is kind of coming like that. Hello. the way you stay present is you stay present to it. Actually, we can't leave the here and now, so you can't really be somewhere else, honestly. So the here and now that we normally think of here and now, of course, is a complete fiction, right? You know, it's like, be here, you know. So, you know, we're training ourselves to be present to what's going on, actually, right? So, you know, of course, if we're, you know, thinking about something in the past, we're present to the past, aren't we? You know, but if we're talking to somebody over lunch and we're thinking about something in the past, that person may say, you're not paying attention because there's some mustard right here, you know. So please pay attention to your mustard world, you know. But we're training to pay attention. So being present to, being present with ourselves is being present. Actually, the idea of, you know, a present now in that sense is just total fiction. So, yeah, I know. It's okay, you know, for conventional speak, we say, well, I'll be here now, you know, but you can't find the now. Yeah. One last question here. Yeah. Yeah. When you do this, it means you're coming back to the sensory experience of touch. Oh, okay. Maybe you need to. Okay. Well, of course, what's actually going on at this point is open to debate. But we, you know, we're present. You know, you can say, well, I'm present to my imagination, or present to, you know, sitting in the chair, or something like that. You know, so in Vajrayana, particularly, you know, we learn to train the imagination, right? So, you know, there's. My rant sometimes against American Buddhism is sometimes it becomes naive reality Buddhism, you know, where the whole idea is just being present to conventional reality. You know, somewhat like if you just lived in Vermont all your life or something. But having lived in Vermont. Okay, so, yeah, so if we're not present to our imagination, and this is very important, ladies and gentlemen, is that we won't, the imagination will turn into delusion. Okay? The energy level decreases in the mind so that the natural ability for us to create new scenarios and reconfigure experience and be present in a dynamic way goes into entropy, and it goes into, you know, impossible fantasy, and then, you know, delusion. So for an example is, you know, possible, like we all imagined the temple here, right? We were able to imagine it, so we can do it. You know, fantasy would be, you know, well, my favorite fantasy is that I'm going to win the lottery, right? Anybody else have that, like, idea? Okay. So when I stop imagining, you know, ability to kind of like, okay, here's what we're going to do with a temple or a middle way house or something that's imaginal, then go into like, well, maybe I'll just win the lottery and it'll be okay. That's called fantasy, right? But then delusion is, I'm going to win the lottery without buying a ticket. You ever have that one? Yeah, it's like, you know, Ed McMahon's going to show up or something, and you just won, you know, but you didn't buy a ticket, right? That's delusion, okay? So if the imaginal world is not trained, then generally will go over into disassociated states. We won't be present to our experience. And we go over into fantasy. We're start having, very, very unlikely states. And I'm not against fantasy, but if there's not enough energy, it will de-evolve into delusion. And we'll start thinking totally impossible things, such as, I'm never going to get sick, I'm never going to get old, I'm not going to die, I'm going to win the lottery, everyone will like me. Stuff like that, right? Delusional states by not training the imagination. So that's why in Vajrayana, so much work is into training and energizing the imagination, because we believe in our lineage that if we don't do that, not only will our realization or enlightenment be incomplete, and still danger of kind of falling backwards, so to speak, but we won't really be able to help others without imagination. You know, non-imagination would be like when we're looking at the Lotus Sutra, you knock on the door and you just tell people, the house is burning, get out. I mean, that's just straightforward, you know, which is great. What if the kids, either don't hear us or go, we're fine. Okay. And unless we're able to use our imagination or what's called upaya or skillful means, they're not coming out of the house. And we'll either get frustrated with ourselves, I'm no good as a dad or mom or something, or, you know, incredibly sad because they'll burn to death, or worse, bitter, like they got what they deserved, you know? And I talk to people all the time that go through those states, like there's no imagination, so they go, well, I tried, it failed, I'm an idiot, or I tried, it failed, they're idiots, or I tried and failed, and the whole thing is depressing, sad, and, you know, why was I born on the earth? You know, that kind of style, and that's called lack of imagination, right? You haven't developed skillful means. So there's always other options. There's always other things to do to help people. And, you know, as we used to say at Sutter Psych, we keep throwing the jello against the wall, right? You know? So, I don't know. They used to say if you throw pasta against the wall and it sticks, does that mean it's done? Yeah. So I think it came from that idea, you know. But it's even really hard to make jello stick on the wall. Have you tried that? So that's called helping sentient beings. And then it sticks, you know. So to really come to full realization, Buddhahood, we must train the imaginative capacity of the mind to see new possibilities. That's really important, essential, because without seeing new possibilities and creative ways for people to heal themselves and to be free, we won't be effective. We'll say, well, there's a door, it's on fire, walk out the door. But and that's okay for individual liberation practice sometimes, but it doesn't, most of the time it doesn't work. Or I wouldn't be here, correct? So I know, I just want people to behave, do the right thing, but they won't, okay? So, and I won't either. So we need that imaginative world. Plus it has an incredible lot of delight and energy in it. Yes, yeah, totally. I mean, so kind of the Buddhist definition of, you know, what's wrong is somehow we get fixated. Yeah, we concretize things, not embody them, which is imaginative, right? That's what we want to do. We want to embody the world, but we fixate and freeze, concretize, and we only see, like, there's just one freaking way to do things, and, you know, get really monoculture about things. So particularly in Mahayana, we stress that we have a variety of things to do. However, we still follow Hinayana path in the sense that we can only ride one bicycle at a time. So work with various options, but when you pick something, then do it. Best practice is when you actually do. So maybe enough discussion or questions, or good questions. So this style meditation is you're in a very receptive state, it helps to go into a dreamland a little bit, and from that dreamland, dream space, we find the image, we let the image with the most that wants to approach us approach. Let's put it that way. We're kind of opening up, and there's always some image or some energy and phenomena in the crowd that wants to come forward and have a relationship with us. So in this case, we let that happen. We're willing to. It's easy. Okay. And now, formal training and like even in the temple, we have images that are given to us. Different Buddhas and how the altar, tankas and stuff like that. these are meant to be, I should use the term like suggestions for practice rather than demands. Religious traditions become dogmatic and kind of rigid when the only way you can see compassion or love is, the image always has to look like this, right? So even when we're working with images in our tradition, they're going to look a little different for everybody. So even if you say, I want to have a classically formed image of Tara, your green is going to be different than someone else's green, or your Tara is going to be a little different. But the neat thing about shared images is there's a way that when we're doing some shared imagery, there's a different, there's actually some kind of resonance that happens. There's a term in neurobiology, or what I like to call neuro-Buddhism now, called mirror neurons. People heard about mirror neurons? Like our ability of our nervous system to, mirror, pick up, mimic what's going on with someone else. We generally think we're all kind of separate, but we do have experiences from time to time that show us we're not. It's one benefit of retreat, weekend retreat, maybe what happened, maybe not, but when you're on long retreat with people, or if you happen to be sleeping with someone consistently, you may be surprised sometime to find out that you have the same dream, literally same nighttime dream. Or even when people are very close to a teacher, even if they're physically separate, they can have the same dream. Of course, from a materialistic point of view, we go, that's pure random coincidence. But as Jada Rinpoche was talking about last month, well, we can't explain how the practices work scientifically, but they end up with the results that work. So we're going to go with them, I know if you had the exact same dream about somebody in distant remoteness, I'm sure you have, maybe under difficult circumstances, you can't help but be impressed. It's hard to deny your experience. So one of the ways of having, you know, same dreams that connect us, but at the same time are diverse, your own, is through having these shared images. Like just now, one of the images that kind of came toward me, you know, I had one first where our cat Jewel came toward me, you know, so. I'm not going to talk about that one. The one I'm talking about is, you know, maybe that's the most important one. That was first. But, I'm old enough that I remember having art class in junior high. That's when they had art classes. So one of the things we had to do, and the professional artists in the group can let me know if this is standard. The teacher had us pencil draw a cube, a sphere, and a cone. You know, these key shapes and with different lightings and different shadings. Cube, a square, a square, cube, sphere, and a cone, and put those into some kind of different, you know, configurations and how the shadows would work. And it's interesting that on a Buddhist stupa, these forms are very strong. The base is somewhat square, like or steps, and then the central part is spherical or somewhat egg-like, and then the top is cone-like. So I've reflected on this a lot, that these are perhaps very central forms in human psyche. And in Tibetan styles, stupas, there's also the top of the kind of spire is generally a crescent shaped, and then a circle, kind of gold, and then sometimes a little squiggle at the top, you know, like a little flame or a little squiggle. People seen that before, at least in pictures? Yeah. So those are very subtle energy states and very also symbolic. That's half, or that's crescent shaped, and then kind of full moon, and then a little squiggle. Yeah. So we're looking for images that are personal, but you know, some also help us to connect with these universal experiences. It's easy, right? And also, we're looking for ways that they can transmute and change too, because we don't want to, we're not looking for an image that's totally stays static. Right? Not totally static. So that's why a lot of times we do have images of human forms or animals that are important in dream yoga and meditation experience. Because why? Huh? They're not static, yeah. They're growing and evolving, you know. Of course, nature too is not static, you know. You know, it's changing. So we're emphasizing that the image is present, comes present to us, presents itself to us, but at the same time is transforming. So once again, in Dharma, we're always looking at that part which appears not to change. I'm putting it this way on purpose. That part which appears not to change, and that aspect or part which appears to change. So we don't just say, well, things, actually in Vajra, we don't say things don't change or change. Sometimes they do, but actually we would say, things that appear not to change and things that appear to change like that. So when working with images, we work with things that present themselves to us and have this kind of dual aspect. It's easy. So let's have a short discussion and question, because this is a workshop. Does good silence mean everyone has understood perfectly and agrees? That's good. Everything confusing. Yeah. Well, easy image, of course, and I say image too, easy images are breath, right? So generally we start out with breath meditation, right? Because it presents itself to us. And you know, it's rhythmic. It's in, you know, it's constantly transforming, but it's constantly present. This is the way Buddhism is different than other kind of mystical philosophies or religions that say the absolute is completely static, and it's somehow in opposition to what changes. Usually, those two facets are split and concretized and fixated, right? Something is just totally blank or totally, you know, not doing anything. And then there's, you know, crazy phenomenon going over here. In Buddhism, we emphasize interdependence. So we're going to talk about something that is constantly transforming, but at the same time, constantly present, constantly renewing. So it's both dynamic and in some sense, unchanging at the same time. Otherwise known as like rhythmic. So nature of mind is, that's why I say pulsating, that it has a continuous, unending pulsating, continual renewal. So we say it's unchanging. But we say it's changing because it's constantly transforming and opening up like the lotus. So breath is a good image because we also imagine ourselves breathing at the same time. We kind of feel our tummy moving and sound, right? So we hear sound, we feel some moving, and a lot of times people imagine their breath kind of, and we teach you, imagine your breath going out into space, right? Imagine your thoughts riding. I talk about thoughts riding or surfing on the breath. Imagine that, you know, your breath is like, you know, the wind horse, and your attention is like the rider. Right? Those that's imaginal, right? But other images transform too, not just breath. Don't get what? It's consistent. It appears, disappears, appears, disappear. It just, it's continually fresh and appears completely present every single moment. So it's unchanging. That's what we call in Dharma unchanging.
It's never the same, so it's constantly changing.
It is the same. basic mind's the same because awareness is the same. The phenomena that the mind is aware of might change, but the capacity of knowing is just the same each moment, even though it's fresh each moment. The mind isn't the mind and the contents of the mind we can distinguish, right? No, it doesn't change. The content changes, but the awareness doesn't change. The same, yes, you know. I know what's going on now, and I'm aware of something now, then I'm aware of something later. You know, the awareness is the same each time. Do you know the difference between a thought and the content of thought, right? Thinking is an activity, but what we're thinking about changes, right? The activity of thinking is always the same. The activity of awareness is always the same. Things aren't always changing in the sense of something completely different each time. Space doesn't change, right? Does space change? No. So, but it's fresh each time. There's no such thing as dull space, right? Still open, free. Freedom doesn't change. Still, just no blockage whatsoever. So, generally, human beings have to meditate a long time because we're so fixated on the phenomena, right? Just, you know, we can't see the forest for the trees. So, generally, all meditations have to also direct us to the space aspect of the mind, the knowing aspect. So, the things we know can change, but the quality of awareness itself appears each moment just as before. That make sense? You have to experience it to, you know, of course, just description.
I have to think about it because I would have thought that based on, you know, our knowledge of the perception,
you know. No. You know, just gross perception changes. You know, gross, the surface level. We could say, you know, now I'm aware of the carpet, now I'm aware of a person. But the core awareness does not change. No. It's fresh, it's momentary, it disappears and then appears. So it's not static, but each time it has the same quality. So surface level of mind, you know, that's why in American Buddhism so often people say, I said, what's the ultimate truth? And they'll say, things change. No, that's relative. Ultimate nature of mind doesn't change. Why? Because ultimate nature of mind is awareness. Right? Correct? Am I making this up? Am I making this up?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I... Yeah, cylinder. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
it seems it does take some training after our initial going, you know, kind of going into ignorance around maybe 5 or 6 or something, you know, that then we have to train ourselves to see the space, right? You know, that's an interesting part about human development is kind of as, you know, youngsters, really young, there's initially this kind of complete experience, but then developmentally human beings kind of go through their forgetful stage and, you know, maybe it's genetic survival or something and then have to be re-educated. Yeah. Ah, interesting. So that's why we need a stupa. So you need, this is just kind of aside, but we need, you know, buildings and monuments like mountains and rivers and plains, you know, are constantly working on that interaction between, you know, space and object. That's why stupa needs to be out in really open space area. They're designed for big spaces. It's interesting. Is it getting easier or getting harder to do the dream yoga? Do people have a hard time finding image that I... of course, coming and going is kind of a metaphor, right? So, you know, in a sense, we can say awareness arises from awareness and returns to awareness. The reason why we sometimes say arising or disappearing is because it has that kind of rhythmic quality to it, and it's energized. So to express energy, to express aliveness, is very difficult. So, you know, one of Mahamudra-style questions is, how do you know you're alive? You know, like that. So, you know, one, you know, primary way of talking about, like, well, it's alive because it moves. You know, we, as kids, didn't we kind of sometimes, like, find, we'd go out for a walk or in the woods and, or even with a bug, and you'd poke it to see, is it alive? Is it moving? You know? So we kind of like, okay, rock, bug. Rock rock moves in a different way. You know, maybe the rock does move a little bit. So that's interesting. Little pebbles move, and little beetles move too, but, you know. So kids are always kind of working with these fundamental, is that a girl or a boy? Is it dead? Is it alive? Right? Remember that place where it was like, what went on? So, you know, as a way to embody this kind of power, embodied it's like heartbeat and breath and, of course, mind waves. So the energy seems to have that pulsating quality. But like light waves, I guess, it can take place in empty space, see? So it's weird. So the waves themselves don't go anywhere, right? They're just energy. I guess also, I don't know if this is right, hopefully a physicist is here, but you don't see light in empty space, you only see light when it hits the object, right? So you can't see light, you can only see it when it hits a phenomena. So this is like the nature mind. You know, we can't see the pure functional nature of mind until it reveals itself through an image or an object. Somebody was shaking their head. Do we have a physicist in town here? Yeah, like, that's right, yeah. So, you know, you won't see light streaming. You'll see light as the sun, but you won't see the light streaming through empty space. We'll see it because there's, you know, wind and oxygen in the earth. You can see rays, but you won't see that in outer space. You won't see. You need an object for the light to light up. It's interesting, I think. So, to see in nature mind, in Vajrayana, we need to alternate and eventually merge these two aspects to see. So we work with image, and then we take away the image, right? Because that's constantly what's going on in real life. Things appear, and then they disappear. Sometimes people freak out when they appear, and sometimes they freak out when they disappear. So you have different... Everyone has a little different personality structure. Some people are traumatized by things showing up, and some people are traumatized by things disappearing, right? Some people always talk about loss. Lost this, lost that, lost that. This thing disappeared. That person left me. That person, you know. Or some people will talk about, oh, it's just too much. I had to do this. I had to do this. I had to do this. Then I had to do this. And then I had to do this. And this happened, you know. So that's trauma. And that's traumatized by too much happening. But other people, you know, nothing's happening. Everything disappears. You know, I'm screwed. And other people are, it's just too much, I had to do this, and then this happened, 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 now I'm too exhausted, right? The different styles, right? Isn't that so? So in Vajrayana, we learn to work with that aspect of appearance, you know, we'd say is the image, and then disappearance, you know, is emptiness like that. But we really don't split them because even the appearance has the aspect of complete disappearance, and even appearance has a disappearance has the aspect of image. It's easy. Yep. Oh, good. Hi. Okay. Yeah. Got to be G-rated, though, okay? Mahayana means great path. Open path, incomparable path. Vajrayana means like is a part of is you know hyperdrive turbo Mahayana means indestructible. Hindi means individual. No, that's not true. It's all three. It's Triyana. Trifecta. You know, it's Triyana. Yeah. Yeah, we have to do all three at the same time. So, yeah. Yeah, good.
But it was a real thing, I mean, but it wasn't real. So, I mean, it was it happens in the conventional world, but it seems so limited that it's really easy for to do the vote.
Yeah.
Complete sense to me and all that, and it's really fun. It's happened a couple of
times. Well, everything's like that. So, you know, of course, in you know, that's exactly what, you know, we're talking about, is it's real and it's not real at the same time. You know, but in, just to contextualize, we are in this incredibly strong paradigm, you know, humanistic science world, which I enjoy too, but that means that we're not seeing, you know, gods and goddesses or nature spirits. We're not seeing that world in the dream world, or, you know, as a regular constant in our world. You see, we're not, you know, that scene is totally other. But in a maybe pre-modern society, you know, that's going to be as real. The reality that's very, usually very real for us here, like in couples counseling, people lots of times go, I don't like my relationship. Okay, I'm worried about the relationship. That's an imaginal thing, because, you know, you could be saying, you know, I don't like him or I don't like her. See, the relationship is not, you know, is a thing, but it's not a thing, you know? If somebody says, do you have a relationship? You know, they go, well, yeah. And I think, can you point it out? And then they go, well, no. But can you point to your husband or your wife? Yes, you see. So in our world, you know, our personal relationships are extremely important. So that's our big kind of dream world in modern society. I think in pre-modern societies, you know, that world is extended much more to animals and nature and, you know, other beings, so to speak. But, you know, we totally take our relationships extremely seriously most of the time. So, you know, and then people go, you mean I have to talk to him? I can't talk about the relationship? You know, see, that's so. There is a relationship, just like there is the internet, but you can't point to it. It's interesting. So, and again, in Vajrayana, we're strengthening our ability to work with, you know, this huge thing called imaginal reality. Yes. Well, there's two things. That's a good question. So, generally, we're looking, you know, we have to direct people somewhat away from content to process, because we're so content-oriented, you know. You know, so look at the structures of consciousness, so to speak, instead of just what the content is. But also, consciously, it can be somewhat tricky, you know, to comment on someone's content, you see, because you know, we're very sensitive to that. Obviously, sometimes I do, but sometimes, you know, overall, sometimes it's better to just listen. You know, because let's say somebody, like a teacher or somebody in authority, you know, says, "Oh, that's really cool content." You know, that is totally cool. You know, and then we go, "Oh, okay, I'm totally cool." You know, or you know, we bring up some content that is, you know, maybe a little disturbing, and you know, you pick up from the teacher or therapist, you know, like, "Well, that's a little weird," you know, and then we go, "I'm weird," you know. So it's so sensitive, you know. We're so sensitive, so you know, I'm not an art therapist, but I enjoy doing some training with art therapy and you know, sand tray therapy and things like that. So you try to get the child or the person to, you know, draw something or do things in a sand tray and not, like, judge on it. So you wouldn't say, "Well, that you did a really, that looks like a house, and you're really good at drawing houses," you know. You know, in sand tray or painting art therapy, you might try to approach it from a different angle, like, or not even say anything. You might notice, like, "Wow, they just drew a house without any windows." And maybe that means something, and maybe it doesn't. But when you're working with kids, and you know, you just, the traditional thing is, you know, house, tree, in person or something. And you know, they draw a house that's burning down. There's probably something going on, right? So. Yeah, don't ignore that, you know, but, you know, there's, but you try not to comment, you know. Everyone says, "Okay, I'll draw, but I'm not a good artist," you know, and that's not what it's about. So, but you try not to comment, you try to draw out the process, like, "Oh, boy, I noticed you didn't draw your little brother," you know, like everyone else, they have, you know, "Where's your little brother?" You know, so you're trying to elicit someone's process from that, rather than saying, "Oh, that's a really good drawing. You're a good drawer." You know, "Let's put that up on the refrigerator." You know, you try to bring it out. So sometimes I try not to comment, because people then will. It's really sensitive. I know you know what I'm talking about. You bring sometimes things up in a group, and come on in and. Sometimes it's really supportive, you know, and you really feel affirmed and when we're bringing things up in group, but sometimes people say things, you know, and even in a group, kind of circle group setting, and, you know, it can be difficult too, right? You know, sometimes we say things and people kind of go, "Man, you know," you can just tell by their expression, they're judging it, and so sometimes it can be harmful too. I don't know. So it's kind of a wisdom thing. Mm. Yes.
And going back to what Annette was talking about, the mind changing, but not changing.
Yeah.
Is it because we are constantly changing that it's not changing? Because it doesn't change, because it's constantly changing, that part means it's not changing.
That's true also, yes. So the evolving, you know, when I say changing here, it just means that the evolving nature of awareness, the that impermanent nature doesn't change, therefore it's unchanging. But the other aspect too is that it's consistent, the root nature of mind is consistently present and consistently compassionate and interested. You know, that quality and spacious, you know, we could say there are these certain qualities that no matter what the content is, whether you're looking at something ugly or something beautiful or something joyful or something sad, we're still compassionately interested. That those basic things are completely ongoing and don't, you know, in a sense, don't appear from it. They don't change. But the actual, you know, setting, of course, may change and is constant, in fact, constantly changing. Yeah. But that this, you know, the what the what qualities are actually always present and what things are changing is very confusing to human beings, and that's why we're here. You know, we're kind of go, well, what, you know, what can I trust? You know, is that, and usually we're upside down. We're trying to find permanence in content that is incomplete or, you know, is evolving too quickly, and we're not, you know, putting our, you know, we're not noticing what is unchanging. There can be people that are attached to unchanging aspects of the mind too, in a way. And just like yogis that, you know, just you can't get them to do anything, so to speak, right? Like that. Okay. Welcome some newcomers. We're going to walk now. Does it work to walk and sit and talk? Does that work? If people are getting hungry, it's like 10 after 11, so we'll end a little bit before noon. Yeah, and you get to eat. That's good. Yeah, okay. Okay, very good. So we've done the meditation practice of kind of being dreamy, letting images arise and letting them, resonant images, come toward us, right? Come establish, be present to us. But now what, you know? What happens then? Where do they go? Do they just stay there and then, you know, you're following it around like the hand in your front of your face all day? No, okay? Some people do. That would be stuck, you know? When you're stuck on an image, it's like having your hand in front of your face, and generally that's traumatic, right? Generally in trauma, people are stuck with images that, you know, aren't integrated. I'm glad, you know, Patty's writing this down, because we'll have a good book, won't we? Yeah. So, you know, I appreciate people, newcomers, that you may have no idea what I'm talking about, or oldcomers may have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, but for my own sanity and staying interested, I can't be a Dharma teacher that just keeps saying, be a nice person and be mindful, you know. I want to say that, you know, it's like, be a nice person and pay attention to what you're doing. Don't be a jerk, you know, but okay, now I've said it. So, but most Dharma talks are like that, right, you know, which we need to hear for a while. Be nice to yourself. Don't be mean to other people. Pay attention to what you're doing, right? Isn't that most of it? It's true, isn't it? You know. So, of course, that goes, we got that already. So, what we're doing now in workshops is really, you know, what are the depths of appreciation and the depths of creativity and liberation that we can experience when we go deeply into the nature of who we are and our community, our reality. So we always need, like, you know, please be a good citizen and be a nice person to yourself and others. You know, that goes without saying, but I don't want to say that every time, right? You can find books that say that, so you can do that. So now, you know, we want to go actually real tantra, real yoga trains. Like, what actually happens? What? How do we actually, you know, do this training in depth? So. We're talking about, like, we've come to see how experience, we could call it that, but I'm calling it image, you know, comes to us, and then what do we do? Well, in traditional normals, usually the image or the experience gets kind of just stuck somewhere. You know, it's just kind of like reality or life is kind of like walking through a field with some briars or something, or little things that just get stuck to our clothing. You know that experience? You're just walking through, you know, outside, and it just gets stuck. You know, the little things, right? And you know, if we don't clean them off, then they'll get it on our socks, and then eventually in our shoes. You know, like that gets, or it's like walking in the beach too much, and you start getting sand in places you don't want sand. You know. So that's people's normal experience of suffering. Experiences stick to us that don't become integrated or don't become, you know, purified. So standard beginning practice is we just tell people, you know, let go of your thoughts, let go of the disturbing images, right? Isn't that so? So it's just like saying, you know, child, you know, comes and they have a bunch of things stuck on them. And we just say, you know, we'll just, you know, we'll take it off for you, right? That's my experience of, like, being dad and camp counselor. Everything I learned was as a camp counselor. So kids, you're walking out hiking, and they've got these burrs on them, and you can't get it off, you know? So you just say, yeah, you just take it off like this, or worse, you're out hiking and you notice you have a tick, right? So how to get rid of a tick, that's really important, you know? So for most people, we get stuck on certain things and we just need somebody to say, just let go, or here, you just do this. But we don't want to do that with all experiences, right? We want to also remember and integrate the good experiences. We need the energy, don't we? Yeah. So you can't tell everybody to let go, you know, so sometimes I feel like screaming to people like, enough of letting go, like, hold on, right? Mm-hmm. So we, you know, experiences, whether it's sight or sound, or also like food, right? We want to chew the food and integrate it. We want to know what foods to eat and what not to eat. But, you know, we have to take in food. We have to take in experiences. We have to take in energy. We must, you know. So, you know, don't be a spiritual anorexic, right? You know, we don't want to say, like, I just don't want to remember or think anything. No, we want to take in energy and experiences, images that will feed us and feed others. You know, this is my GI theory of Dharma. Maybe Vajrayana, you know, we talk a lot about feasting and Vajrayana, you know, delighting in the food and chewing it, mindful eating, tasting it, digesting it, rejoicing in our fertilizer, you know, that stuff. So, of course, first step is, you know, just drop the rock, so to speak, right? You know, something's painful, hurtful, you know, just drop it, right? But we don't want to drop, you know, sometimes we can't drop things right away, or we don't want to drop the energizing, you know, good, you know, nutrients, right? So, in traditional Vajrayana practice, like if we're doing deity yoga practice, I'm sorry, I'm just talking over, some people have no idea, so that's okay. We'll ask questions, right? Folks in the back, I don't know. So, when you're doing practice like Tara Chenrezig, one traditional way is, you know, when you're done with the practice, you imagine that they go back to their realms, right? Right? So, you know, they'll go back to their pure land. So you invite them to come or they appear, and then at the end of the practice you say, you know, thanks for coming, it's been great, and you watch them go back to their realm. So they just don't kind of, you know, you just don't turn them off. Like I was always said, you don't just push the plug and turn out, you just don't unplug the computer, you power it down first, right? Well, first you save the material, right? Isn't it so? You know? So it's the same way with our experiences. You want to, you know, where do you want to save that experience? You know, or what file, you know, what document? So in our Buddhist practice, you know, these beneficent experiences, we want to save them. So we save them imaginatively in a Buddha field, it's called, or a Pure Land. So they, sometimes people have read the practices, you know, it said they return to their abodes, right? Have you heard that before? They return to their abodes, you know. And doing many times in Vipassana or Mahamudra practice, I know these are terms not everybody knows, but just pure awareness practices, then the idea of the experience of space is so supportive and so real that it's a container. Most of the time, space is seen as just kind of empty and nothing. But, you know, the more practice we do, the objects and the space are you know, mutually powerful. So in awareness practices, you're dissolving the thought or the image, you know, back into space, right? Or you're just letting your awareness, you're letting your thoughts, you know, dissolve into the room, the space, right? People have heard this before, correct? But of course, when we're saying dissolve into space, or the Buddhadeva, the deity, returns to space, this isn't kind of the empty space of modern physics. This is the, you know, womb-like nature of space, of our experience, right? So the space is resonant. It isn't like, you know, it's just being dumped, right? So it dissolves into space, right? But as some people know that done some darshan with me or anything, after a dream, many can ask, like, where do you experience the energy in your body? See, in Tantra, we're going to bring it back to the body, particularly, you know, embodiment. So, you know, what do you experience in your body right now after telling the dream or having the dream? Sometimes that's the most important part of a dream, isn't it? Because it isn't always the content of the dream, it's what the dream delivers to you. Like, I just, you know, people say, well, I woke up really scared. And I'll say, well, what do you want to do with that energy now? Right? Yeah, you just got a lot of adrenaline. You want to do something with it? No, I don't want to do anything. I just want the adrenaline to go away. Okay, well, you got some energy, right? Generally, when we repress our energy, what's going to happen? Depressed, right? Of course, if we don't know how to handle the adrenaline, the anxiety, you know, then we begin also to, you know, shatter and wobble. So, you know, we learn how to embody it. That's why so many of the energy practices of yoga are learning how to embody the energy rather than just, you know, discharging it or repressing it or acting it out, right? So in the meditation I'm going to suggest now is that, you know, when we've gotten some kind of, you know, hopefully positive or enlivening experience or image, then we want to see where do I experience that image in my body? Where do I want to store that in my body? When we're reading Vajrayana texts and they talk about body mandala, it doesn't make any sense if you don't do this practice, right? It just feels like, well, what's the body mandala? No, body mandala is how do you embody your experience? What's it like to, you know, embody these profound images and experiences? Where do you store the energy? That's easy, right? You just feel it in your body. Well, it's not that easy always, because we're used to relating usually with thinking that energy comes from without the body, you know, like someone's touching us from without, or we're taking in a smell from without, or we're taking, you know, a sound with from without. So we're training that actually the all these senses and experiences are also happening from the inside, right? We're not getting rid of the outside. We all live outside, but also inside. That's important, right? So all the outside experiences we have, we can also generate from the inside and store them. So we can be Dharma camels. If you can't store energy, you can't store these good experiences, it's like having a car with a gas tank that just holds a pint of gas. You know, you could, your experience is jerky and you have to constantly be refilled, right? So to be able to store energy, you know, it's like having huge resource states or gas tanks, right? You have long, or maybe being electric vehicle, you know, we can go long, long ways. We don't always have to have, you know, constant stimulation. Wouldn't it be nice if, like, we just had, like, we're so sensitive to our experience that we have, like, you know, one little square of really great chocolate and that lasts 5 years. We just go, I can still taste that chocolate. That is, you know, somebody says, well, when you last have the chocolate? Is that just, you know, a few minutes? No, that was 5 years ago, and that was so good. I stored that, and, you know, so I don't have to have another piece, maybe another 5 years, but I'm good right now. That's what Ajnana practice. It becomes so, our system becomes so able to store experiences in a positive that, you know, we can run long periods of time without needing outer stimulation. It's not that we're boycotting outer stimulation, but we can run long periods of time, right? So just example, like traditionally in Tibet, even in the monastery, as I mentioned before to the students here, like, you know, you don't get to see your, you know, root teacher once a week or have hour-long interviews. No. There are 5,000 monks, you know? They're, you know, you're not going to get your hour every week or something, right? And even, you know, Tibet, small little villages, and your teacher might, you know, also be, you know, a distant village over a couple of mountain ranges. So, you know, you go, walk, 2 weeks, a month, get there, you have your, you know, 20 minutes, and, you know, ask your question or get some teaching, and then you walk back to your village or your retreat hut, and you go on that for a couple of years. Right, you have the capacity to store and absorb it, and work off of it, you know, without constantly reading another book or asking another question because you're on retreat, and besides, your teacher's maybe on retreat too, or you know, two mountain ranges over. So, you know, we do want to train to that place where, yes, we can absorb a lot of energy and run off of it. So I'm not saying I'd like people to call me and I like to meet with people, but I also want to train you to be able to have big gas tanks, right? That's traditional practice, you know. So one of the reasons, just a little bit about me, just one of the reasons I'm respected within the Vajrayana community is, you know, after my teacher died, you know, I just didn't, you know, which was 1998 now, I just didn't go, well, that's that. I'm done. No, this is still a continuation, right? Because in Tibetan system, you're not just going to go, well, my teacher died, so, you know, that's that. No, you just keep on carrying it forward, you know, you don't just suddenly say, well, I'm done, right? So, you know, in Tibet particularly, maybe because of the distances, even more in India, you know, develop these huge carrying capacities. And one of the best ways to do that, of course, is, you know, actually carry it in our body, carry it in, you know, feeling it, right? It's amazing. Unfortunately, maybe the way human nervous system is designed, that we have the capacity to store a lot of stress, anger, and hurt forever, right? Isn't that the, you know, it's like, well, I still got that in my shoulder and still feel my aching heart from high school, you know, my stomach's still a mess from my last divorce, you know. So we have the capacity to store, you know, trauma and negative experiences. Isn't that so? So that also should let us know that we have an incredible capacity to store, you know, the open dimension experiences also. Does that make sense? Yep. So a few questions and then we'll do a meditation and go to lunch. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The absolute real question is, we're doing it right now at Lion's Roar, because there's Dharma, deep yogic states and realizations have never, well, up until maybe now, have never been taken out of the context of an alive mythic world with close relationships. This scientific, individualistic kind of humanist world has never existed before, I don't think. So it's a total experiment. You know, we just take it for granted. Well, we just take Dharma from Asia and we put it over here. No, it's never been done before, so we're still doing it. Like, how do we do these advanced tantric practices and deep realizations when we're, you know, running around doing families and doing businesses, which generally were not done at all in Asia, right? You know, just credible handful of exceptions where people raised families, had businesses, and attained deep realizations that just really just jump out, you know, because it's so rare. So that's why, like, you know, before, like, you know, Jada Rinpoche came, you know, talking with Geshe, and Geshe said, you know, Rinpoche is really interested at how are we doing this, you know? Like, how do we manage to do this? How do we manage to have, like, temple setting with people coming and going, you know, Lamala's doing his job and family shit, and, you know, and how are we still managing to create this kind of environment, you know? That's not normal for the history of Dharma, right? So that's somewhat that you're interested in me. I'm somewhat an anomaly, right? Like that. So that's one reason Tibetans are kind of interested in me. Like, well, he seems to know something, but he didn't, you know, he didn't do the traditional monk training, and, you know, so how's that happening? People don't know what I'm talking about. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because traditionally it would be like you can only kind of have some good product after going, you know. You know, of course. One question?
Well, I was saying, you don't know the success.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think it, you know, it's, you know, in a way I like to say think how it works and then go backwards. But, you know, we don't always, you know, we can't say on the whole, like, well, how's, you know, deep experiential states going to be transmitted and contained in, you know, the military, industrial, humanistic, scientific complex, you know, like that. How, you know, we can't say exactly how that's going to happen. Except I'm just kind of like, since I don't know how it's going to happen, I'm just going to choose a positive result. If you don't know how it's going to happen, then who cares? You just, let's go with like, well, let's just imagine it's happening and go that direction, right? So, but a big, big piece in Dharma, and then maybe we just have short meditation, is in Vajrayana system, of course, is the emotional connection, the devotion. So that's strong in our tradition. So that will pull. That's the golden thread. That will pull, right? That will pull. Yeah. So you can see the intensity, right? That has that intensity. So in our tradition, you know, sometimes we're seen as like a little bit dramatic. Like that. So that's why the lover aspect, you know, that intense love is the most important. All right, got it. So can we do? Let's do 10 minutes. Can you wait? Next, yeah. Come back. Okay. Thank you, everybody. We'll reassemble at 1. For those who are coming back at 1, I hope you find a nice place to have lunch, or you brought your lunch, or you're going to fast. I don't know. For those who are not going to see in the afternoon, I hope you have a good weekend, and see you again. Newcomers, please say hi to somebody, right?